right, tonight we're doing it old school style. Welcome to another episode of What You Guys Talking About?
What you guys talking about?
So I am sitting here. We are both kind of exhausted this week, guys. I've got, just so you know, I'm in insurance, right? So this is the end of month, which means an insurance world. It's a crazy time. My markets, I work in what's called directors and officers insurance, has been in free fall for about 2 years. And everybody looks to me for solutions. So we're doing a very late night cast tonight because I had to finish. I finished work very late tonight. And Eddie, over the weekend, you had a shoot, didn't you?
I did. I was on a shoot for a D&D friend of ours.
That's right.
That's how we met them. Hyunju and Will. Hyunju is a Korean director who moved to England with her husband Will earlier this year, and they were like, hey, we need a sound person, and we hear you do sound.
So let me just, because Ed gets called about this all the time. Now, it's not that we're not both actively looking for, like, hey, do you need a DOP, or do you need a director, or something like that, but I tell you, it's like magic that Ed gets called for sound, because I just know that's... So why is that, Ed? Why is there always this need for a sound guy? And if I can be honest, not to shoot down what you did, but what does the sound guy have to do then when he shows up?
So a sound recordist, first of all, why are they hard to get a hold of? Mostly because they are quite rare, and therefore will always demand a fee.
Okay.
And that's why I learned to do sound.
Okay. Was this a paid gig you just did over the weekend?
No, it wasn't. Okay. So here's the thing. I tend to be, and I think we both are, tend to be of the opinion that you have to help people out. You have to kind of make a group that you feel comfortable calling up for favors.
Yes.
When our projects come along, and so this was me wanting to lay some groundwork with some talented people for, you know, when we do one of the many things that we're currently working on.
No, that's completely right. And we're not creepy about it, but you remember I'm a lawyer in my background, and we spec this whole thing. I mean, I was asking Ed all sorts of questions about who's, and this is the type of stuff that I just think everyone should really be doing. It's not creepy to know details about the people you're working with or what they're good with or to figure out how they could benefit your network. Something I learned a lot in my day job, and, you know, in insurance, it was very much people business. But, you know, with film, I don't see how you do it without teams. It's kind of the brick wall that I'm hitting now, because as you guys know from the production journals and stuff like that, like, I'm working on Breaking Out, You Reap What You Sow, which is a very good script that I wrote, but that was written way over budget. It just, once I started breaking down the script, I realized I just wasn't going to have money to do all these things I wanted to do on this short. So I've actually started working on another short based on the film we watched and we're going to talk about on this podcast. But my hardest thing is I got the idea. I know how it's supposed to be shot. I still need the team, even though I'm doing, I mean, this one that I'm writing now and have written, you know, it's meant to be as low budget as possible, enough that basically whatever I make for the month, I could throw on it and we could get it done if we need to. But I still have a need of, you know, I've got action scenes that I don't. Yes, and a lot of it comes from,
yeah.
And sorry for the ramble. I just find it interesting. I think other people would too. Like, what I find interesting is, like, I work as a job as a lawyer where I'm expected to know so many things. And often what you have to tell people as a lawyer is that you may not know it, but you'll know where to go for it. With film, it's similar that I don't know how to do 3/4 of these things that I want to do, but I can find people that can, or at least that's what I'm trying to build for us this year. And Ed is trying to build by going on these shoots. So, you know, for any of you that listen and do have shoots you want us on, you know, we regularly post up for our friends on that kind of stuff. And rarely do we ask to get paid, to be honest. Now, a paid gig is awesome. And if you need someone with, you know, if you need something with a huge time commitment, then yeah, we're definitely going to need money for that. But, you know, if you are an up and coming filmmaker and you've got a project and we think it's cool, we might jump on for free. And that's how you do it. You know, that's how Ed gets the people to come, you know, on crew for me. That's how I get the different people I need to do on it. It's just an important thing to know. So, you know, Ed, on the weekend, it may seem kind of interesting, you know, that he traveled, because he traveled quite a long time.
Oh, yeah. That was, like, this weekend.
I hadn't mentioned that before. So, yeah, but he had to go to Exeter for this, which is very far from where we are. We're on the other side of England.
This weekend, I traveled for about 12 hours. I shot for about 6 hours.
Yeah. Life. See, aren't we making indie filmmaking sound so glamorous to you? Yeah. I'm sure you
should. But also to answer your previous question as well, what does a sound recordist do on set?
Yes, thank you. Getting back to the point.
A sound recordist collects dialogue for the scenes that on location.
Mm-hmm.
Also really, really important is a sound recordist will collect wild sound.
Okay.
That means literally just the room tone of a room. They'll record for like a minute so that the sound mixer can then layer it on in case they need to do ADR, which is automatic dialogue replacement.
Yes.
Or automated.
Okay. So example in context. This is a problem we had on Dandelion. So Dandelions, again, I love using this like 5-minute short. That was a complete accident.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Oh man, I've milked this so much. But okay, so going to Dandelions, because if you haven't watched it now, you should have. Because I've talked about it on every podcast for the past 6 months, it feels like. But okay, so we had an issue with the dialogue on that, because I didn't do what Ed was saying. So what I'm talking about is, because I moved to different locations in the forest, and I mean, I could show you probably about 2 hours, you know, where they all are, but they're not close to one another. Like, I knew what shots I wanted, so I knew what trees and what areas I wanted to go at. So then when we put the dialogue together, there was, you know, not skipping, but there's these problems because it doesn't sound the same. So luckily, that's when, you know, my wife often comes to bail my ass out. And on this one, she had gone into our backyard and recorded birdsong for about an hour. So I had a lot of this because she finds it interesting. She's an ornithopterist. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
She likes to watch and study birds, and she's very good at it. So she recorded this, I think, for an hour so she could pick up the different birds that we have in the yard and try to find them.
Mm.
So luckily, we, you know, took a minute of that and just put it over, and it worked perfectly for the thing.
It,
you know,
ties everything together.
But so important. Remember, all I'm saying is heed what he has said, because it's easy to miss. You need to, if you are the sound recordist, then any place you're recording, you need to get static noise of what's going on there at the time. It will come up later. Just do it. Just go out there, record a minute, 5 minutes, as much as you can get while you've got time. And if you're the director or you're on the other side of this, you know, this is your crew, you're above the line. Well, you've got to remember this, because if you don't, when you get into post, wow,
yeah,
like that's it's annoying. That's really annoying. Like, yeah. Oh dear. So yeah, good on you for explaining that, Eddie Spaghetti.
Thank you very much.
It is in popular demand. Sound recordists and editors. It's all I've heard since I started this. Mm. I'm getting better at being an editor, and Eddie is a decent sound recordist. So we try to cover the jobs that no one else wants.
But it was a night shoot, which are always tough.
Mm.
And one isn't as young as one used to be. So pulling an all-nighter has, like, just a longer effect, you know? So it takes me, like, a solid week to recover.
Or you can be like me, I just don't sleep. You know, I've got I was telling Ed, I come on over here, it's about, what, 10:45 here, and I've got an 8:30 in the morning with my other job, so I just don't sleep
anymore. The life of an indie filmmaker.
No. You know what I mean? There are plenty of times. I think it's a really important thing to talk about, because one of my pet peeves in this world, and this is a rant, guys, ooh, get excited, get tasty.
We will get to Memories of Murder.
We haven't even talked about the movie yet. But you know what? Make your own schedule, guys. I mean, I work a 9-to-5, which I have a lot more flexibility with now because I'm being forced to work from home because of COVID-19. But work from home was always something that I pushed big on my day job, because I'm the kind of person, I like to run hard for 6 or 7 days. And then maybe have a day or two where I'm just completely crashed out and then back again. That's how I operate. It can go up to 14 days like that. And the recovery times can be longer. And I'm talking in general. I mean, this isn't just, am I going to work hard or am I not? This is, what projects do I have going on in the film stuff? What projects do I have going on in my day job? What do I have with my family stuff? It's all the juggling. But what I've realized for myself, at least, and I would encourage you to evaluate for this, if you get control over your time schedule, it's a lot easier. Now, I'm going to have to get very little sleep tonight and get up the crack of dawn tomorrow. Probably be up by about 6 anyway to get my daughter out the door with my wife. However, I'm used to it. Mm. And when it comes to Saturday and Sunday, I'll make up for some of that time because I know what my schedule's like.
But that's a very, very good point, I think, for anyone who wants to do this filmmaking thing. And, you know, inevitably, you have to put in the hours and your own time and stuff.
Yeah, like you're going to run into... Let me just walk you down the path of the stuff that I see. So the first question you have is, you say, is I need to go to film school. I need to go because we live in a society that promotes going to college. Film is not one of those things where you have to go to film school at all, okay? Especially in the current, you know, university generation we have, which they're all getting screwed for paying too much money for a degree that's worthless. Don't waste the money. The only thing you gain from, as far as I know, is if you get into those top law, you know, top film schools, it's just like going to a top law school, it will open doors at places that will only hire people that come from those areas. Mm. Okay, I know that from, again, from the day job. There were certain law firms that will only hire people from Oxford and Cambridge. So, you know, that's the way it is. And so that's what I mean with film school. So the next step is, okay, but what do I do when I want to learn? Like, I've got to quit my job so I can do this. No. Mm. If you want to be an independent film director, the first thing you need to learn is to have an alternate source of income. I was telling Ed last week, one of the greatest stories in the Guerrilla Filmmaker's Handbook is the second chapter about the guy talking about film school. And he's a plasterer.
Mm.
And he's like, listen, you know, pays the bills when I can't get work.
Yeah.
That's how it is, guys. We, you know, we don't have a lot of paid gigs these days. We have a couple, but we don't have many. And you've got to make it from one end to the other. So the next thing is keep your day job. And then finally, step three, climbing the producer, director, writer mountain from Jason Shiro tips to everyone else who's listening this late at night. Ned, who's falling asleep over there, like, is he going to shut up or is he not? Step three is time management. I mean, I get asked every single day now. The minute I had a short film at Fright Fest that any one of my friends knew about that knows me from my day job said, how did you do that? Mm. Listen, a lot of it is not sleeping, but other thing is just organizing your schedule and being able to accept what you're able to get done in the day.
Mm.
The thing that people get screwed up about so much is planning with film. If you don't shoot anything, doesn't matter how much you plan, you have nothing in the can, and you're an indie film director. So if you're at our level, and I'm not saying you have to be if you're listening to the show, but if you're rising up, you need to be out there with a cameraman as much as you can and balance that against other things. If you can't get to something one day, then don't get to it.
That's the key. Balance. Balance is definitely the key.
Always. Some days...
Planning saves you... can save you money and time and these things.
It's just, it's all these books, man. They have like, write your goals down. You know what? My goals can change on a daily basis. Why? Because some days my family has to be the most important thing. Right. Other days my job has to be the most important thing. And then other days film is the most important thing. And I have a family that respects that the priorities shift depending on what's going on. I don't agree that you can just put it down and put it in cement if you want to be in the indie filmmaking world and do that. Because the problem is you're going to have times when there's going to be huge demands on you, as Ed is explaining. And we aren't as young as we once were. So if you don't want to spend the rest of your life not sleeping, then get it organized.
Yes.
Cool. All right. So let's get the name of this correct first, because I think I got it wrong like three times. I just so enjoyed the film, I didn't care what it was called. But what was it called, Eddie Spaghetti?
Memories of Murder.
Okay. So we're not even going to... We're like halfway through this already anyway, so we're not going to really worry about spoilers. If you haven't seen this film, it's an old one.
Mm-hmm.
How old is it? Do you know it?
2003.
Wowzers. So I was still, God, I was just still in college when that movie came out. Wow. Yeah. And would you say this, did this come over to the States and to the UK, or is it very much Korean cinema that was missed at the time because of when it came out?
Right. This is, it's part of the kind of the strongest period of Korean film, the early 2000s, and the Hallyu, the Korean wave, which... did get to, you know, Europe, and particularly like through Khan and stuff like that. But this was quite early on. I feel like Old Boy is probably the first one that just blew the doors off the international market. But this, you know, people realized very quickly, oh, wait, they have really great films.
Well, there was a definite buzz, and I'll just interject with a little bit of story here, because I think Ed's got the most to say about this film, because he picked it, and we had a really good time watching it. But what I remember with stuff like this from the Korean wave, I remember going out when old 2005 would have been, I guess, when Old Boy was coming.
Exactly.
And I always liked cinema, and I'd been watching indie films in Cali before I moved over to Korea. So the idea was, like, this is sweet. I just wanted to see what some Korean cinema looks like that has... And the only real problem always was, like, are we going to get some English subtitles yet?
Right.
Just to interject a really funny story, shout out to my man Mark James McDonald. He's, like, one of my oldest friends. He's also my Ned Flanders. I just, like, I love the guy but can't stand him at the same time. He's so much better human being than I am. And just
I love his mustache right now.
I just saw it because of his kids' post. Like, oh, Mark, that mustache. Like, why haven't you always had that? Yeah. You are Flanders to me. So now it's like, official because you've got that awesome tash, dude. But Mark went with his girlfriend at the time, now his wife. This is really funny how many of us came back from Korea with our girlfriends that ended up becoming our wives. But Mark and Hannah have been together as long as my wife and I, and he took Hannah to see Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's laughing because he's heard this story. But so Mark goes to the cinema to see, this is Wallace and Gromit, so English fair, you know, Hannah's very excited to go. And all of a sudden, there's no subtitles.
Yes, it's been dubbed in Korean.
Yeah, and Mark, the reason I call him Flanders is he is the ever optimist. You know, he's a social worker, he's a hardworking guy, and just, you know, just one of the best dudes I've ever known.
Lovely Canadian man.
Yeah, just like generally just one of those, I mean, you know, traveling the world, you literally don't meet that many cool people like him. And so he just sat through the whole thing. And I just remember sitting there, we were at a Bored Cat Cafe, and like a week later, like, what are you doing, Mark? And he was like, well, I didn't care. I was like, but could you understand? And he's like, well, I could understand some of it. And it was like, there were no subtitles. He's like, yeah, it was a cartoon. So I just, for me, I was the opposite. I couldn't, do that. So we had to find something with subtitles. But, okay, so going back to the point, and sorry, I am hijacking your discussion on this, because it's that kind of evening. Old Boy already had some hype to it. It was like the, have you heard of Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance?
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't, but I was like, oh yeah, yeah, dude, I totally know about Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. That was badass, wasn't it? Oh yeah, man, Park Chan-wook, he's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then they mentioned other names, and one of them was...
Bong Joon-ho.
Bong Joon-ho, who everybody knows now, because obviously Bong Joon-ho has done Parasite and has bowled the world over with everything. But this was his first, I think.
This was his second.
Second.
Dogs Don't Bark.
Is his first.
Is his first. Barking Dogs Never Bite.
Okay. So this is his second. I mean, God, Ed. I, you know, Parasite was okay. You've heard my review of Parasite. It seemed samey to me because we went through the Korean way. We lived out there for all of these films. And once you catch one, you want to see them all. Because trust me, if you go through this time period from like 2005 to 2010, I'm telling you, they're all good.
Crazy.
There's just... And they are very samey. They all have twists. They all are... You know, there's this... you know, getting into the depth of what makes the Korean wave so interesting. Mm. It's this hyper-reality. Like, it's reality, it's Korean reality to me, because Korean reality always felt like hyper-reality. So instead of having a room with 10 people in a computer room in Korea, you have a room with 100 people with computers in there. Everything is more compact, bigger, just more expounded there than I found from where I came from in the US. And this is an American saying that. I found everything, not bigger by any means, but... There were more people, there was just, and everything was louder.
More energy, more speed to things.
And so the Korean films, like, what I love about them is they don't Hollywood the shit out of things. Like, they do just the opposite. And this is why the guy who's in Memories of Murder,
Song Kang-ho,
right, is again in Parasite. And you wouldn't always know, because he always just plays the town guy.
He's so good. He's
a phenomenon.
He's hands down.
They all
never,
are.
He was never trained. And like his first film, I was talking to Hyunju about it the weekend. She was telling me that his first film, he was playing some kind of gangster, street gangster. And the people on the shoot were convinced he was actually a gangster.
Well, what's apparent, and you know, we try to pick on different things and things that we like, basically. And what I like about him is he's clearly a person who either understands or has spent a lot of time with actual people. He is not, you know, you can read, I've just given, you know, Ed back this masterclass books. And one of the things they talk about is the naturalism of actors. It's why Ed and I talk rehearsals, because I don't have as much experience as Ed, but I'm always querying them, because a lot of big directors will throw away rehearsals saying it ruins the spontaneity. Now, I asked Ed, saying, well, the indie director level, not the Martin Scorsese level. Like, should I do rehearsals? And he was like, yes. He's like, actors will really appreciate it. But what you want from an actor is a natural performance. You want it to look, I don't know, it might still be a con, but you want it to look like it should on the film while it's still looking like it would if you walked into a cafe. And this is what this guy's got in droves. Like, he looks like someone you could walk into the local cafeteria, because this is how they, you know, this is how you eat in Korea. You go get your local lunch in the cafeteria. They got water. They got dongkas, which is this chicken steak that's delicious. But it's full of people just on their minutes between their job. Mm. And this is a guy that would fit perfectly in any of those scenarios.
He's chameleonic.
And it's just amazing to me. He just seems like the everyman every time.
And, you know, like anyone who's seen Snowpiercer, for example, has seen him. Mm. He plays the father in that kind of engineer guy. But, you know, he played a vampire in Thirst, mm-hmm. and he is, like, hot in that. Mm-hmm. And he, in none of his other films, does he exude a kind of sensuality.
He brought up Thirst. See, you say sensuality, that was my one biggest complaint about it. It's the one Park Chan-wook shouldn't have done.
Really?
Because Koreans can't do a vampire. Sorry for the big generalization. Someone posted, you know, shoot me on Facebook for this, because I shouldn't say that. But Korean film... okay, doesn't do intimacy very well. The whole concept of a vampire is based on sexuality. So it's...
don't worry,
it's a problem, because what happens is, you know, if you look at Thirst, everything's fine until she finally caves and they have, like, that first vampiric kiss, right? Mm-hmm. It looks wooden. It looks really wooden.
Okay.
And that's the problem. Like, you can't tell a vampire story without sensuality. Well, I guess you can. Vampire Cop Ricky works well.
I love
that. But that was
film.
A comedy about a guy. You have to go watch this Korean film. This is what we're talking about with cinema you are missing but could be enjoying right now. Yeah. Vampire Cop Ricky is a film about a guy who gets bitten by an infected mosquito. Yeah. And this is another great salt of the earth Korean film. Like, it just walks through life, you know, as you would in Korea. But he gets bitten by this mosquito, and then anytime he gets a boner, he turns into a vampire. And I mean...
so he's chasing a bad guy at one point, and he pulls his phone out to get some, like, porn on.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing, like, and you know, to be fair, guys, and I'm just going to throw it out there, I'd like more across my desk lately. I'm not getting as many people. You know, I always talk about I wouldn't have that, or I would produce that. Like, we're still open for business, guys, so, and we have room in the production schedule. So, you know, if you want to send me your work and say, like, will you help us make this? That's what I do. So, yeah, please do. And I haven't had as much lately. But... what I was thinking with this one is, man, like, Butt Boy was the one I was like, no, I would have shouted him out of the room. This one I would have been like, yes, man, yes. Like, oh my God, you're a genius. We're going to do this. I'll get the porn right now. So, no, I would have been behind Vampire Cop Ricky 100%. Yeah. It would have been like, this is the coolest
movie. That's an absolute clear memory.
It's up there with flesh-eating death, you know, death monkeys. Like, we're going to do it, man. Yeah. We're going to do it. Flesh-eating death monkeys. All right. So... tell me why this film has such an impact on you, because there is a backstory to this film that you've mentioned in another podcast, but I really, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about how it influenced me at the end here, because it goes into kind of what I'm writing, but I want to hear, this had a huge impact on you, this film, mm-hmm. and you were so excited when I dropped you, because this is for my birthday. I turned 38 not too long ago, and we went on the Friday, it was the day after my birthday, down to Camden Market to go see this.
Oh, that was so much, that was so cool.
It was just nice. It was surreal at times, though, wasn't it?
It was a little bit, yes.
Camden on a Friday night, and wasn't anybody there?
I know, yeah. And it's a lovely place, you know, lots of Instagrammable stuff. I will say I wasn't crazy about the quality of the screen, but you know, you can't have it.
Yeah, sorry, Stevie. Sorry, Curzone. Like we it was pretty close. It was pretty clear when we got there that they were like just desperate for anyone to sit down and watch.
Please
this film.
Watch this film. And you went in your shorts to an outdoor screening, which was probably a mistake.
No, I was. Well, yeah. I mean, by the end of it, I was like, wow, it's getting pretty cold out here.
Yeah.
Blanket would have done me well, but. I would say that the film was engaging enough that I didn't have too many problems with it. I was just absorbing, because Ed and I, the other good thing that happens with this that doesn't normally happen is, you know, I talk all throughout cinema. That's why most people don't like to go with me. But Ed and I will talk through the film that we like. And this one, Ed just kept going on about the country shots. Mm. And this will, as I said at the end, I'll tell you a little bit about how I used that. But yeah, I mean, it was beautiful. And it took us back kind of that to that rural. Maybe you like them because you're Spanish, because it also reminds me of Spain. I still remember one of the greatest journeys of all time was the flight from Madrid, or I'm sorry, the drive from Madrid to Salamanca. Mm-hmm. That was my first trip to Europe, first time I ever used my passport to go out of my country. I was so excited, like I was going to the University of Salamanca for a summer to study there. It was one of the greatest times in my life. Beautiful. But I tell you, the drive between Madrid and Salamanca, we saw fuck all, mate. We saw one camp, like campesino. Yeah. And I was like, what is he doing out here? And the guy's like, going out here to die. And I was like, holy shit, like, I've never seen a country quite, like that. And I come from Ohio.
Desolate. Yeah, it's quite desolate.
Yeah, like, especially a guy like me, I come from the big Midwest. Like, we have cornfields, but there will be towns between them. There was nothing. Mm. There was absolutely nothing. And it just fascinated me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so Korea is similar. Korea between, you know, these really built up cities. So if you went from, like, you know, Pohang to Daegu or something like that, in between,
there's not a lot.
There's not a lot.
No.
Or maybe I'm saying that wrong. There are things there, but it's just such a different lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is the contrast. But you know, going back to your question earlier and how this particular film impacted me. So I was living in Spain. This would have been like 2004. And a cinema around the corner from me, which I used to go to. I loved this place. This was when I was really getting into film.
Mm.
And they started putting on, like, film series. So they did one
on... I love when they do that.
Yeah, they did one on Ozu. And that's where I watched, like, Tokyo Stories for the first time.
Ozu shooting at with the shin. That's where he shoots from.
Which I absolutely love. And they did one on the Korean Hallyu as well. And there was a bunch of films that I saw. I saw JSA there. So that was the first film that I saw. The Park Chan-wook film about the joint security, the DMZ. And it's, again, one of the best films out there. Again, Song Gang-ho. But I got really interested in Korean movie, and I picked up Memories of Murder. It was in a, you know, DVD rental place.
Mm.
I watched that and I just absolutely fell in love. And that's honestly the moment where I said, I've got to go to Korea.
Mm.
Like, I need to be there for some strange reason.
Yeah, well, hey, stranger things have happened. We were that age in our lives, man, where, you know, you're only 6 months older than me. So, you know what I mean? Like, that's how it worked at the time. It's funny, when I got there, I wish I'd gone earlier. Like, I probably would have stayed in Korea from, like, you know, post-college on for a couple years. But as it turned out, I went, you know, 2 years after I graduated. But, okay, all right. And so how did that, I'm interested in kind of following the story a bit further with this. So how did that impact when you hit Korea? How did watching, you know, the Korean wave live up when you got there?
It's funny because, like you say, there's just something surreal about Korea. It's like hyper realistic, like you say. Just the speed that everything's at. And, you know, when we first went out there, we weren't in Seoul. We were in, you know.
No, and always remember, Ed, like, because it is a big difference, I guess. Like, I never went to Seoul.
Yeah.
So I used to vacation there with my wife.
Right.
And it was a good place for a party. But I never lived in the big city. I lived in, you know, the city I lived in, Daegu, is roughly the size of Chicago. It felt plenty big to me.
It was fairly big, yeah.
You know, the longer I'm away, the more I realize there were some inherent... It's like the difference between London and everywhere else, you know what I mean? Or New York and everywhere else. Like,
exactly.
There's just things that would have been in Seoul that weren't in Daegu.
Yeah. And so Memories of Murder particularly had a very strong vibe of what it was like to be in Chilgo, in the countryside, down in the south of the country. I think that, you know, inevitably film tends to look at, you know, very interesting things like serial killers or, you know, the DMZ or whatever, spies, right? And so We never experienced any of that. The closest I think I ever saw was, I think I saw some gangsters having a Barney outside a bar one night. But you know, you know that stuff like that's going on, right? That it's part of the fabric of the country, North Korea, you know, like everything that goes on. And so it was very, very eye-opening. And looking back on it now, actually, it brings a smile to my face.
Good.
I will say that.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing. I was surprised, and we always go back to this on these podcasts when we talk about Korean scenes, so we apologize, because as you can clearly tell from the two podcasts we've done about Korean films, we missed the place. And like I said, that's where I am going to retire. Like, I don't care if I hook or by crook. I'm getting my apartment next to my mountain, and I'll walk up it every day, because I used to love to do that. But I would say the thing that will get you, would get a Westerner about Korea is it's like an alternate reality, because we have an impression, we're taught over here, not deliberately. It's like all this stuff that's coming out of the woodwork about how we really talk about slavery and how we really talk about these things. But, you know, we're taught that it's a bit backwards over there. You know, at least up until recently, with China, was always considered as this country where everything was cheap as chips, but they all were poor. You know, Korea, I remember people were like, "What, do they eat cats over there?" I'm like, I don't know if they eat cats or not. I don't even know what it looks like over there. I really had no idea myself what I was getting to, other than to say, pretty sure they have technology.
Yeah.
Pretty sure there's some pretty big companies out there. So, you know, I'll see what it's like, but should be all right. I mean, you get there and the technology is better than where I came from. Okay, better than LA that I was living in before there. So already I kind of had shit on my face, because it was like, yeah. Oh, I thought this was going to be worse. But they were, you know, 10 years ahead of what we had at the time. And then the other thing was the way that everything just worked in a completely different way. So in a society where individualism is not as promoted as it would be in ours, I don't want to say really more than that, because I'm not Korean, so I couldn't give you the details of how it's that different. All I can say is I use examples. I'm, you know, not Einstein, but I like Einstein's, like, when he used to use pictures to explain things. If you ask a friend to the cinema, he will go with you. A Korean friend to the cinema. If you ask a Korean friend what he saw last night by himself at the cinema, he said, "I didn't go." Because they won't go by themselves.
Right.
Even when they go to play esports, which is their thing, man, they are freaking amazing as a country, because it's one of the things they've promoted with their kids.
For decades,
And there is a career in it. You can make a career as a professional gamer in Korea if you wanted to sell your soul and give up all that time, because it's not easy. But they all congregate in a PC bang, which just means PC room. And that's all it is a room full of PCs with people on their computers, but they are more comfortable doing that. I asked, why don't you just use your own computers? Nobody has them. Or if they do have them, they won't have these things on them.
Yeah.
And so things like that used to really do my head in, except, like, it worked. So the hospital, when I went to the hospital, my poor wife, another great story, had an appendicitis in Korea. And this was not near any decent hospitals. So, like, I remember she was in a dentist chair and the guy had, like, a surgical knife, and it was like, holy shit, this is going to be bad. So she had to get it cut out, and he showed me the damn thing. And then she was obviously resting in a Korean hospital. Mm. And I'm like, wow, well, isn't it great that the nurses are going to take such good care of you? And they pulled out a bed. And I was like, what's this? They're like, well, you're staying, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I stayed for a week. I had to work. I think I slept all of an hour every day that week, because I would run between my job to check on my wife, to bring her food and things like that. But that's just how it's expected in Korea, to keep their costs down. And because you to get free healthcare, it's like we had to pay for that. But you are expected, your family is expected. And they were all there. When I turn around in the morning, everybody's families were looking after them. You know what? That's not such a bad idea. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's different, right? It's, and again, it's hard to judge these kinds of things.
But, going into story then, why don't you tell the listeners, because we're getting on with time here anyway, tell the listeners a little bit about the story and why it's so special to you.
Yeah. So this is the story of, based on real events.
Is it really? Yes. I never knew that. I think you might have mentioned that, but I didn't know.
Yeah, based on real events in the Hwasung area, which is just south of Seoul. It's near Suwon and stuff like that. A number of people, a number of women were found bound. Wow. They'd been raped and murdered. And this follows the story of a police detective, played brilliantly by Song Gang-ho, who's trying to catch the killer, and a special detective who gets sent from Seoul.
That's right. It's a buddy film. Cop, yeah. Buddy film. Yeah. So just to explain what kind of film you're looking at, it is a buddy film.
Yeah. So, and it's a lot of it. There's a lot of play between, you know, the country guy versus the city guy who's been to college and all of that, which is, you know, it's a big thing in Korean culture, right? Oh, you're from Seoul. Oh, you went to university. Oh, you know, it's a massive part of the culture there. And it's their chase of this guy. And I found out in preparing for this that the guy who actually committed the murders he confessed last year.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And Bong Joon-ho.
Oh, now I'm going to have to look this up.
Yeah, Bong Joon-ho said that, you know, because he spent so much time with the script and the story and the film, he would picture this guy in his head. He couldn't like express what it was like to actually see a picture of the real guy. Mm. You know, it must be crazy.
And it's the one thing I will say. I mean, it's funny you said that, because maybe this isn't how Bong Joon-ho felt about his own film. But for me, like, one of the things I loved about it, and something I imported into the short that I wrote, you know, kind of off the back of it, is that what I loved is that the focus is not on the victims or the killer.
No, yeah.
The focus is on the investigation. Mm. And so what I mean is, you don't, honestly, I mean, at least I didn't. I didn't really care if they found this person. I didn't think they were going to.
Mm.
The way it was going, it was like, I'm not sure there is. I don't know what the killer is, but there just was too many things going on in two different directions. However, I loved seeing the reversal that happens between the two buddies. So that the country mouse starts in being the bombastic one with the idiot ideas, and the one who's always trying to set up. I mean, he's a dirty cop.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's trying to get a deal done so he can move on with things.
Mm.
And the Seoul cop comes down and chastises him for that, rightly. He says, what the fuck are you doing? You know, you can't be a dirty cop. We can't catch a killer based on this.
Right. You can't just beat every suspect up to get a confession.
I mean, there's two things that are great with that. The first thing is the realism. Because what I was telling you is, you know, coming from Bufu myself, you know, East Bufu, you know, in the middle of nowhere in the Midwest. Yeah, that's what you worry about in a small town.
Yeah.
Cops will do what cops will do.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I'm not knocking cops, all right? Like, I don't have the job. I don't know what it's like. So, you know, that's not a commentary on small town cops and the fact that you guys are all crooks. It's more saying, it's a small community. You have to do things the way things are done. Yeah. Like, it's not necessarily...
Resources are limited.
People, you know, have like, perceptions of the way things are. So that is what that is trying to show you with his character. And then you have the city cop who's always doing stuff. You know, he's the one that we know Pace in the UK and be citing all this stuff to you. And there's a reversal that happens in this film that is brilliant to show that, like, you know, everyone always thinks that the issue is black or white. It's so gray.
Mm.
I just think I love stuff like that because I think it's a metaphor for what's going on in the world today. One of my, you know, Ed hears this every podcast, but people need to stop getting over being right and wrong about all these issues that we're talking about. There is no right and wrong on all of these issues. And I don't care how many comments you put in Facebook. Okay. The idea is, when we're talking about issues of race, when we're talking about issues of, you know, government, of COVID, all these things, there is not one right answer. And we live in a society now where people tend to think there is. And that's a huge problem.
Very true.
You know, everyone thinks they've got it on the tip of their tongue. And it's like, well, no one really has it on the tip of their tongue.
No one has the answers,
You know, there's just a potential way forward. And this is an investigation that kind of blows the lid off that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it opens with the finding of a dead body, which, again, is beautifully mirrored at the end of the film, when he goes back later in life.
Mm.
But yeah, it's very much, I would classify it as a neo-noir in a lot of ways, because of the focus on the investigators as opposed to, you know, the victims
that's the thing, though. I mean, this is story of film, my friend. Like, film school major that I am, I should get they should give me like an honorary master's now. Because
a piece of paper that said I watched film.
And I know, just because because actually part of it's noir, but part of it's also this what Godard did, and I'm not as over the moon as everyone else about Godard, but I understand why he was so powerful, because he kind of introduced us to something that is very popular, the day in the life film. And because no one had really done that before. A couple people had tried, and definitely in foreign countries, I've seen a couple of films now that are very much trying to show a day in the life to show either oppression or things of that. But he was the one that said just day in the life. Mm. Like, that's an interesting topic for people to watch. Mm. All that reality shows that you watch now are based on that kind of concept. Right. That's just, it's not really reality TV. It's produced reality for you, but people enjoy that. Point being, like, that's what this cop thing was. It was a day. It's always in Korea a day in the life. Like, and that's what I love about it. You don't just meet the main character. You meet the people he works with. You meet everyone around him. You meet the, I mean, it's, you're also seeing elements of Lars von Trier realism. And they're saying, I don't want to see, you know, I don't care about plot as much as I care about, you know, the surroundings with what I mean? Like, I'm just remembering because I watched Dogville last week. I had to after we've been talking about it so much. And it was like such a strange film.
So weird.
Such a strange film. But so enjoyable at the same time. And like,
that's interesting.
I was trying to explain this to my wife because, you know, she's caught this and she's always curious about where I'm going with my mind in the film career and stuff. And now I'm trying to kind of show her the niche stuff, the independent cinema, and why that's so interesting, because I didn't quite get that before. Mm. And now I do, as changing the way we do things in cinema changes the way that everyone looks at everything in cinema. And that's why it's so profound. Mm. And so I think the Korean Wave combined a lot of previous elements, right? So you're talking about Godard's Day in the Life with some film noir and said, we can make a film that entertains you like a studio film would. And that's where I think they've really got the edge, because these look and feel like studio films. However, they have that beautiful, innovative indie vibe to them. Mm. They just have this, we're not going to do things the way you're used to seeing them. Yeah. We want you to see it. You know, the way they jump in and out of things is actually reminiscent. The other person doing this a lot these days, and always has done, is Almodovar. Like, you know, Todo sobre mi madre, Amores Perros. They're always about relationships on top of the story. Like, you never really care, you know, All About My Mother. The guy, you know, sorry if I'm going to spoil it for you. So don't, if you haven't turned it, put your fingers in your ears right now. Yeah. The boy dies in the beginning. That's the whole point of the movie. In the beginning, the boy dies. But it's like Psycho. He dies and you're like, wait. Because when I read the synopsis of the film, it was all about the death of the boy. So you figure it would happen at the end, right? Because that would be the big climax. No, I can come to grips with his death. Instead, it happens in the first 10 minutes of the film.
I mean, it's very interesting. I think this film in particular, the cinematography is so breathtaking.
So let's transition into talking about that. Because I definitely, because we're running out of time, because we're both very tired here. we're running out of time, and the one thing you did continuously talk about while we were through there, and the thing that gave me the inspiration for the short film later, was talking about the shots and the cinematography. So why don't you go into a bit of detail about that and why it's so special in this particular film?
Yeah, I think it's actually something to note about that time period and the directors that were coming out of the Korean Wave.
Sure.
Whether it's Lee Chang-dong or Park Chan-wook, in that they are craftsmen. The frame is so beautifully balanced. Like, while we were watching, I kept saying to you, oh my God, I love the symmetry. I love the symmetry of that shot.
So in the shot, he says that on to me, and it was perfect symmetry, because the camera panning, and I'm sorry, the camera moving forward through a hallway. We're on each side of this hallway, we were like, it was mirrors or...
It was doors.
Doors, but they were perfectly, like, perfectly.
And it was an outhouse.
He hit the exact center line.
Yeah.
And it was like, and it's just, it shows that, like you said, Ed, this is what I love about the camera now, and why, as I said, I'm going to have to go back to being a producer. Like, remembering that we need money, you know, to make these things. But, man, you can elevate shots that way. Mm-hmm. So when it's symmetric, it makes something, it made an outhouse, and this is why I just brought it up, it makes a shitter look artistic.
Beautiful. No, gorgeous. And again, it's the use of symmetry and asymmetry. In that particular shot, he pulls back until one point where he unbalances the frame, and he's showing you one side in particular, building tension, right? So it's not camera movement or framing for the sake of just doing something beautiful, which I've been guilty of in the past, but it's storytelling through...
No, that kind of pull away, the best that I can remember, and I can't remember the film, but they were talking about a particular movement with that, where the director, and this was in the story of film, again, I encourage all of you to watch this, because you will learn so much from this thing. But what the guy had done, it was a scene where it was a black and white film, so it would have been an older film, 50s or 60s or possibly the 40s. But there was a scene where a guy had just gotten yelled at by his wife, and he was going to make a call on the phone all embarrassed. Mm. And the camera pans away from him being on the phone because the camera is embarrassed for him.
Yes.
And it's like, that's the kind of stuff that separates, to me, the men from the boys.
Yeah.
Like, when you can show an emotion like that through your camera movement, then you've started to understand why cinema is such a compelling medium. Mm. You know, why it gets you. Mm. You know, there's other reasons. I play lots of video games too, and now this is how the horrible way my brain works. I'm starting to see the different cues in video games now that you continuously go back to use similar to camera techniques, the things that we use in video games to engage you, to keep you moving, and you know, it's game theory, basically. Yeah. And so I had never considered, and sorry, I'm so ranty tonight, it's because I'm tired, but I had never considered film in that context as being a short circuit to the brain. Mm. To me, it was just like looking at a picture or something like that. Mm. But once you understand, and that's what you're talking about with these craftsmen, you know, once you have that kind of understanding like these craftsmen, there is just so much more you can do with a person's mind. I know that sounds terrible, but that's exactly what we do in film. Mm. We are manipulating, to a certain extent, what we want people to take away from it. When you know what you're doing, and that's all I'm saying, and I don't, so I'm you know, Ed's the guy who knows what he's doing, but when you know what you're doing, it's magic. Like, yeah, it's exactly. Absolute magic. It just affects people. And
sometimes
people.
You stumble into it. I mean, I think about that final shot.
He pointed at me when he said that.
No, but I think about that final shot in Dandelions, and just what a beautiful, perfect, poetic, melancholy moment. Like, it's a sad shot.
That's right. So when I play it, not anymore because I've seen it so many times, but when I played it right when it was getting up for its festival run, so it's single festival run, and we still might play a couple other places.
Might get some.
No, I mean, I've been, a lot of guys, we've had quite a few rejections on it lately, and everybody's been like really apologetic, and I'm getting kind of sad about the apologies. I'm like, don't worry guys, you saw like 1,000 submissions, like,
yeah.
It's because I'm really nice and I talk to them all the time. So they're like, we're really sorry, man. I'm like, dude, it was an iPhone 10 film. Like, I have another one that will be with you in 6 months. Right. Like, don't worry, I've got more. But what I will say is I cried after that scene for a bunch of times because ultimately at the end, people ask me, well, why did you make that film? Like, where did it come from? And to be fair with you, I move so fast when I'm making this stuff because I just like making it. I don't always know. Like, I don't. When I wrote that script, I had no idea where it was coming from. It just came from somewhere. I put it on paper because I wanted to make it. Mm. And I called Ed and said, how do I do this? Like, I want to put this together. That really is how I am with a lot of projects these days. But I just don't like sitting. Like, I know you have to perfect scripts. And I know they need to be great. But for this particular project, like, this was me working with my wife in lockdown. Like, I just wanted to get it done.
It was the right thing and the right time.
Some projects, like the one I'm working on, you know, a segment for a feature, that I'm being very delicate with because it's for a friend that I respect, someone who could give me further work and who has a good studio. So we have to make sure You Reap What You Sow reflects an adequate balance of budget and style.
Right.
This other thing that I've just written, which is another kind of murder on the field story that has echoes of what we watched on Friday. I just told Ed, like, I want to shoot something in October, so we're going to do it. And Ed knows what I'm like. He's like, okay, we'll get people together. We'll fucking do it.
Yeah.
But that's the difference. And so, you know, at the end of Dandelions, when I finally came back to it and said, like, what is this all about? It was about loss.
Mm.
And like, I do feel that very deeply right now. My daughter, and part of it is that she has no brothers and sisters. That was a deliberate thing so we could provide for her, you know. But the other thing is, like, it's hard when they're at home and they've got no one to talk to except for you.
Mm.
And you just worry. You worry, 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 worry. And they don't make it any better in the news by saying, like, children need to be doing this.
Yeah.
And you're just worried that you're scarring your child. And so that film, as artistic as it was and was not at the same time, because remember, it was a 5-minute, you know, thing that I really just been pushing through everyone's nostrils. I'm still talking about it here. It did have that was the core for me. That's where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested after we get done with this one on the field to know where that came from, because something sparked really quickly in that. I wrote it really quickly, sent it to Ed. He was working the night. It was on Saturday. Sent it to Ed, and I expected you to come back and be like, I'm not sure I like it. And you were like, no, this is great. And I was like, okay, all right. It did come out all right.
It felt very doable, which is a big part of, you know,
yeah, That was, I think, part of the difference between You Reap What You Sow story and this one. This one, it is a good story. I think it's a good story. It has a good couple of twists in it, and plays on the topics that I like playing on right now. However, it was a single location. And I mean, another way I could tell you with the writing, and rambling tonight, but another thing I could tell you is, if you want to do something like that, all I kept doing was visualizing the location in my head.
Yes.
Like, I don't know
I think that was a big influence, because we talk so much about the countryside in Korea, and because...
And I had seen the pan shots, because one of the things we're not explaining entirely well, he does these wide shots that I really liked, because they work, and they remind me of Korea. They remind me of where I come from as well. Because you have these wide farm shots. And then sometimes, and this is what I did in my short, he takes the action across the wide shots. Mm. And I just think, as an opening shot, and maybe sometimes to let people know how crazy things are, it worked. Because you would see this troop of people doing things across the field. And then there'd be some close-ups and some more interaction. And then they'd be trooping back across the other end of the field. And vice versa. And it just makes you understand how nothing is happening out here, because you've got this kind of commotion on going on, and no, you know, it's not a city, so no one notices this.
Right.
You know, and
again, beautiful use of a shot to express something more.
That's right. And so, and he has lots of these. The other really cool shots for me are the ones, you know, I've been reading a cinematography book. It's currently what I'm reading, a cinematography book that says you have three shots, you know, and actually quiz.
Mm.
Do you know the three shots? There's only ever three shots you're supposed to take. Well, traditionally.
Okay.
Traditional three shots. In
wide, it. Medium, close-up?
More so, what are the types of shots? That you've nailed that, but what are you going to shoot? What content-wise? There's only three types of content.
Okay.
So there's the protagonist, what the protagonist sees.
Uh-huh.
Someone looking at the protagonist,
uh-huh.
and the protagonist doing something.
Okay.
Technically, there are schools of film that believe that those are the only three things you should ever create a shot for. Obviously, people have broken the rules many times from there. But that's the core. And he plays that well. Again, craftsmen. These are people that have read these rules and played with them. And that's what I like, because I got a whole notebook full of stuff. Playing with it's the fun part. So you have that scene where the boy killer is like... And we don't ever know if he's really the killer.
Right, like the big suspect that they think...
But he's hiding.
Mm.
And I thought, because the camera is from his perspective in the back of the woods...
Oh, okay, when he's stalking the...
God, that was a beautiful shot. Because he has this choice, and what happens is...
That was a cool shot.
It's not just the story, it's how it's set up. So... At this point, you know he's going to kill again. The rain has fallen, and all this is going on.
The song is played.
And we all know, shit. And unlike Silence of the Lambs, you're not really worried about the killer. You're more worried about, shit, we know some victims are going to be out there.
Yeah, exactly.
And the cops aren't going to get there in time because we're watching them as those. What are they
and all? You know both potential victims.
Yes. So you've seen earlier in the film, you've seen both potential victims. And so they both start on a quarter down one another.
Mm.
But what they don't know, the dramatic irony that's generated for you, is in the background is the killer watching. Mm. And I just thought, because he watches them cross and then it shows him looking to each and picking one.
Great shot.
Beautiful. That's great. Show me, tell, you know, show me, don't tell me the whole way.
Yeah.
Because the other way that could have been is in the way I've seen it done, and you know, I'm going through some MCU and some stuff right now that just isn't done properly.
Yeah.
Shout out to the MCU, though. I got through Iron Fist, and I won't make any comments on the podcast about it because I don't want
to. No comment.
But then I did my What If episode, which is the one where, and Ed had seen them also, and spoilers if you haven't seen S.H.I.E.L.D. But the S.H.I.E.L.D. episode where you know, basically they're in the Matrix. And so she's married to Ward, and it was great. But I only had one episode before, and I have to just do a shout out because... You know, James, I just want a job, man. Like, I'll be your third AD, your fourth AD. I'll be a fucking runner, but I'll need some money. You know, like, James Gunn, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, first time I'd ever seen it, guys. It was spectacular.
Mm.
Spectacular.
Mm.
Like, I can't believe. And part of what he does well does echo into Memories of Murder, because a lot of reason Guardians of the Galaxy works is because it's a day in the life kind of film.
Mm.
In other words, his characters are not superheroes. They're always real heroes and then superheroes.
Okay.
So, you know, it's the jokes. It's the raccoon. It's the...
For me in that film, when Yondu dies, like, I weep.
Yes, but that's why it works, because part of the reason that the Iron Fist doesn't work... Okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do this now.
Oh, no.
Part of the reason the Iron Fist doesn't work is because the characters aren't believable.
They're just so dull.
It's not that they're dull. Exactly, but they are dull. They're dull, though, because they're not a day in the life. They're not people you and I could relate to.
Yeah.
And when we go to the cinema, sometimes we want a messiah out there. Sometimes we want someone who's not like this, but... Man, how good does it feel in Guardians and Galaxy when they say family? You're talking about, you know, Drax, a raccoon, a little tree. Like, that in our brains couldn't be the farthest thing from family. But the minute they say it, because of the interactions they have and the jokes that they have and the things that they do. As I said, I love, you know, the death and the conversation with Raccoon, because he's saying, there's lots of us.
Yeah.
We all hate ourselves. And this is why we act this way, because we hate ourselves. But at least we can try to do some good in the world. You know, there are going to be a billion people in that cinema. Not a billion, but a lot of people in that cinema that can relate to that. Yeah. And be like, I always thought I was just like that.
That opening to that film with Baby Groot dancing whilst they're fighting is one of the best openings I've ever seen.
I know. That harkens back to your love of... that reminded me of... what's your other guy that you love so much that would do something like that? It's the playing with the foreground and the background. Mm. I mean, that's all it is. But it's such a wonderful way to
do
it. You know what I mean?
So good.
But what's that? That reminded me of Shaun of the Dead guy.
Edgar Wright.
Yeah, because it's cut so well, because it has to be... Stuff like that has to be cut precisely. Like, you have to... The cues have to be at the right time.
Yeah.
But just was blown away. I mean, this is a guy, again, James Gunn didn't have a lot of things that he did. I still haven't seen his kind of indie flicks that he did before.
His trauma stuff.
Yeah, before he did, Guardians of the Galaxy. But Jesus Christ, is he talented.
Good.
I mean, dude, like, you're supposed to be this indie director, but you have... so many elements in your films. I would love to just understand how you process all of that. You know what I mean? Like, how you go from small stage to big stage. But sorry, hijacking a good 5 minutes of this to say Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was freaking amazing. And yes, I'm always late to the party, but you know.
One shot that I definitely want to talk about before we wrap up is the climactic scene, the tunnel scene.
Yes, this was... Ed very much put it out as his favorite scene. We both agreed it looked gorgeous.
It's so good. And I think that like hollow darkness of that train tunnel in the background, it says so much about the scene that you're witnessing, where, you know, the city cop is sure that this is the guy. Like, he's 100% sure. They're waiting on the DNA evidence from the States. It's not arriving. The kid is, like, getting away from them and stuff like that. And they end up out just outside this train tunnel. And, again, that darkness right in the middle of the frame, just, you know, emphasizing this lack of a soul. And you feel that is very much... At first, you feel that that's about the potential killer, right? The suspect. But actually, it's about the city cop losing his soul, because he's willing to go to where the country bumpkin police officer was at, where he's like, I know it. I only need to look at someone and I know they're guilty. He's losing all of that made him...
Well, see, and what I really find interesting is that's not how I interpreted it. Okay. And it's not that I disagree with your interpretation whatsoever. I just, again, it's what's the shot for?
Hmm.
For me, the shot was showing the climax that we wouldn't actually know how it was going to end. Because you come into that climax thinking you know what's going to happen.
Hmm.
They're going to finally catch this guy. They're going to beat the shit out of him. They're going to put him behind bars, because it's like every other 80s cop film. That's the other reason Ed loved this, by the way. And I did not get to mention this, but Jesus, does he love a good cop film. And this was like...
5 days to retirement.
You know what I mean? Like, he has shown
me... I'm getting too old for this shit.
I think you have two scripts with me. You know what I mean? Which I looked at him like, wow, man. I was like, are we going back to the 80s? Like, Come on, man. I want to make this.
I love those movies.
I'll make it for you, man. Just for the sake of making something where we got, like, Taylor Riggs again. But for me, it's because you had an undefined ending. And the director knew that in the story, but we don't know that.
Mm.
And so it was only because he uses this technique again in Parasite.
Mm.
And I believe he uses it in Snowpiercer. I wanted to watch it because I could have sworn I remember the shadows being used this way. But in Parasite, this is where he uses to talk about that basement that you don't really know anything about.
Mm.
So when they go down into the first basement, because there's two of them, the first basement, that is always the same camera shot that you're talking about. Now, obviously, it's not done over a train tunnel, but it's the same effect of he has the entire back end of this entrance to the basement suited, you know, in darkness. So people come in and out of this, and it looks really strange because you're never quite sure. And then obviously that's where all the action goes in Parasite, is in and out of this basement that has a second basement, you know, and all that stuff going on. So for me, it's that he uses that shadow as a bit of the unexpected.
I could see that.
Less so than, it's different from, like, and the reason I'm distinguishing is, like, Coppola uses shadow for his characters. You know, you taught me that, because I said, well, what is it, you know, we did the top 10, you said, well, what is it about Coppola that you love? Like, what makes him as a film guy so cool? And then, obviously, I've gone back and watched, and yes, he through the use of lighting, darkened his characters, because it's his only way of non-glamorizing mafia figures, because that film does glamorize them. They makes them look like... Well, at least they fought for their family. And still, they're killing people. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not making a judgment either way. I'm just saying, you know, it's not glamorous. The only way he could darken his characters was by doing that, by sitting the dawn under a dark light and saying, like, he may, you know, he is a person that sits this way in the shadows. You know what I mean?
That's how he lives.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's...
Yeah, no, I could see that. Definitely the uncertainty. And the trouble is, I've seen this film so many times that I know how it ends.
No. And I mean, the other thing I will say, and it's just noticing, this is the stuff, and this is why I want Ed to talk about it more, because it's a whole different side of the storytelling that I think... Having listened to, and I do listen to a lot of directors now, and I do apologize, like, I'm not trying to criticize you, but I am critiquing you when I'm listening to you, trying to think of what things do I need to pull from what you're doing and what could I do better. I've seen an emphasis lately, overemphasis, including myself, so I do listen to my old podcast too, just for the shits and giggles, on written story. And the problem I have now is, having looked at the whole process with more depth, you know, I have to say, Ed always tells me a film is written three times. When it's written, when it's, you know, made, and then when it's edited. That's very true, okay? What you put down on the script, it's important. It is really important, okay? It is not everything. It is not the only bit of the story. You have got to get somebody on there that can do something with the camera that makes the story sing. Okay, or makes a story tell, because it's a visual art. So where the Korean Wave succeeds so much better than a lot of other 90s films. 90 films, what were they shit for? Well, they were shit for all the excess. That's when studios had these amazing budgets. So it almost harkens back to that, you know, 1920s with what was it, amazing film? The one that the Hollywood, where they had more extras than ever done before.
Oh yeah.
Not Inferno, but the other one by D.W. Griffith, right?
Not Dante's Inferno.
No, that's the most expensive film ever made. This is
Cleopatra?
No, but it's like that. Yeah. So it's like Ancestry or something like that. And I mean, you see the stills from this thing, and they still have some of these monuments in Hollywood, like huge. But the 90s is when all of a sudden money started pouring in from DVD sales and stuff like that into, you know, studios. And so watch 90s films. They're bigger than a lot of other films that you will watch now. And you know, MCU is probably the legacy from that. You know, the studio films that are still like that are the big budget 200. You know, Dune will be a version of that. You know what I mean?
We need to talk about that as well at some point.
Yeah, we can certainly talk about it. Let's talk about it now. We're over time anyway. So,
okay.
New Dune trailer hit.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I want to know what you think, because obviously I don't have the kind of connection to the books.
I told you what I thought. I thought, isn't it ironic as hell, because I'm a narcissist, that I'm growing my hair out long, and it looks just like Paul Atreides. Which I just like. Sorry, Paul Atreides has been one of my favorite characters in a book for, I think the first time I read Dune, I was 10 years old, 11 years old. So, and I've, you know, not worshipped Paul Atreides, but he's supposed to be special. He's perfect for a narcissist like me. He's supposed to be unique in the world, and no one else can be quite like him. And he has a terrible purpose. And when I was growing up, I will tell you, I had a lot of those feelings.
Right.
I was smarter than most of my peers, if not all of my peers, which I'm not being an asshole saying that. I'm just being honest. You know, and it made me feel very different from everybody. As I said, I wondered whether it's like borderline autism. But in the same sense, I always knew, because people always do stuff with you, you know, the amount of people that tell you what you're going to be at that age because you're so smart, Like, you feel like you have terrible purpose, that people are going to make you do bad things at some point because no one will ever be satisfied with you. Again, at the time, this is the time I love film. Mm. I wanted to play and do things like that. And you find that when you're intelligent like that, people don't ever just let you do what you want to do because everyone's got an agenda. Okay. And so when you read about Paul Atreides, which, you know, Dune is very much about everyone having an agenda for Paul Atreides and him saying, fuck that, I've got my own agenda. Mm. So that's like part of it.
Right.
So the trailer that came out, sorry, getting back to your point. We were talking about me. I like to talk about me. The trailer, it looks beautiful.
It does look beautiful. My only worry is I love Denis Villeneuve. But I felt that with Blade Runner 2049, there was a little bit more style over substance.
A lot of people said that. I think Blade Runner in general is a story like that. The original story is like 60 pages from the original Blade Runner. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip Dick.
Yeah.
Great story, by the way, if you haven't read it. Much more intensive than what Ridley Scott did. But what Ridley Scott did was brilliant. You know what I mean? Like, it just was ridiculously brilliant. So,
have you seen the documentary about that?
No, I saw Blade Runner for the first time like 3 years ago and was like, what the fuck? Why did no one tell me about this film?
And if you want to know what it's like to fucking have your whole crew against you, like as in them wearing t-shirts.
Wow.
Saying,
Cameron's like that though, man. Like, as I said, I love to hate on him. I love to hate on these new Avatar films, but you know, someone was saying about Titanic, it was like, man, everyone told him that film was going to bomb. And I'm like, I know, because it cost so much money as well. And it did.
Yeah, Ridley Scott, I mean,
he just seems, I'm sorry, that's James Cameron.
Yeah.
But Ridley Scott as well, you know what I mean? In that era.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm not confusing the two of you. I'm just saying. You guys know something
similar. Like I say, I'm excited for it, but I don't have that kind of connection with it, you know. So I'm like with anything, like with Star Wars or anything.
I have learned as I grow as a filmmaker, as my new chosen lifestyle, so to speak. I really do feel like I've transitioned into being a filmmaker. Like, that's how I feel because everything in my life kind of exudes it now. And so what I would say is this, I've detached myself from the book because you will never represent that book properly. Right. It's not meant to be represented properly. Right. I wouldn't think the concepts of religion being a drug of the masses or conspiracies like that, as long as they stick to the...
Is it a visual medium? That's the question.
Yes. So that's the thing. Like, and David Lynch got some of it. It was David Lynch, that did the original, not David Fisher. So David Lynch did that. Like, he understood. That's why the Baron Harkonnen is such a creepy looking guy. Mm. And that is why, I mean, it stings me when I never stand that. I'm always like, oh, fucking
glory. I struggle a little bit with Patrick Stewart in that. I don't know why, because I love Patrick Stewart, but I think it's because it's pre...
He plays Gurney Halleck, right?
He plays, the trainer.
There's two, right? So there's three, actually. So there's Duncan Idaho.
I think he plays Duncan.
See, Duncan's the one that goes and lives amongst the people.
Okay.
And that's where that was really poor. So the biggest problem you had with David Lynch's version of this, and sorry, David, this wasn't your fault. This was the 80s. This was the time you shot it, is that it whitewashes a film that wasn't meant to be whitewashed.
Mm.
Okay? Paul Muad'Dib. You know what I mean? This guy, Frank Herbert, was specifically referencing, you know, a certain peoples.
Yeah.
You know, the nomadic peoples of the desert.
Yeah.
And he's not joking about that. And so if they don't cast it right this time and put a lot of those elements in it, there's going to be a huge backlash. Mm. Because I'm not saying he's setting up Muad'Dib like a caliphate, but it's close.
Right, it's really
close. And if you read the later books, it is a caliphate. That's what he's doing. And he's trying to explain the madness behind religion through the caliphate.
Mm.
And so...
Frank Herbert, right?
Frank Herbert, man. Brilliant writer. A bit derivative. So read the first book, the second book, and maybe the third book. After that, all he is trying to do is push you away from religion and say... Religion. No, it's not money grab. It's more his diatribe against organized religion. And I completely buy it. It's the reason I stopped being a Catholic, because I bought hook, line, and sinker what he was saying, that it's used to pacify you. It's used to get you to do long-term things.
Interesting.
See, and it's a manipulation tool, just like, you know.
So this is the first part of
this is the first book. The book's right. big. It's 600 pages. That's the other qualm that I might have. Again, everyone's always said, let's just do it as one. They did a mini series.
Yeah.
Then people didn't like that as much because they condensed things into it. So it's like a 2.5 hour movie, right? Like, are you going to get it all in there, mate? Because a lot of things happen.
Yeah.
And it's like, what do you keep and what do you cut?
Have you seen Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary?
No.
So Jodorowsky was a filmmaker in like the 70s, I think, mm-hmm. mostly. Very kind of Lynch slash Terry Gilliam.
Oh, no. I know Jodorowsky. He did, I've seen all his other stuff. So name me some of his other films.
I can't off the top of my head.
He does all... So his films can really disturb you if you, but he has this one where like Jesus climbs to the top of a mountain and then he's greeted by someone else. Mm. And there's a woman he always has these films with like women with completely shaved eyebrows and kind of are completely naked. And they, you know, there's one, his other one is where they do that to a woman, like not in a bad way. Like they're not gory. They're just.
Disturbing.
The 70s disturbing. Right, like, right. They're deliberately that way. He's very metaphorical.
So he, like, plowed a lot of time and energy into adapting Dune for the screen.
Okay.
And it became, like, this legendary thing that, you know, the work that he'd done and so much
I
so.
I can imagine it, yeah. And he would have been decent for it. I mean, it takes a weird hand like
yeah.
that.
But so much so that they made a documentary about it, and it's supposed to be a fantastic documentary.
That's the thing. It depends on the angle. Now, this is going to be big blockbuster, so that's the other problem you have, it really tests whether this book was ever meant to be a blockbuster. Mm. It's definitely a sci-fi opera epic, okay? Yeah. Up there with Battlestar Galactica, Babylon 5, all those great stories, Star Trek Next Generation kind of deal. However... It's not like Star Wars. Star Wars, you know, never was a book, thank God, because it was written as a film with a protagonist. Like, it's a Kurosawa film written as a sci-fi film. This is a book that was written as a book. So right. It's just, it could be all right. But my point is, you're going to have to toss some of the book and say, this is the actual story I want to tell you. Lynch tried to do that. That's why I give him so many props, because he at least took a stand on it and said, this is my interpretation of what you're supposed to understand about Paul Muad'Dib and what's going on. And it's not perfect, and it was all over the place. And the final cuts...
I need to rewatch it.
Yeah, the longer cuts are a little bit better for it, because then it explains kind of things you're missing. But it never quite goes... You know, one of the greatest films to ever watch a director's cut of is Highlander 2. Because if you watch... It's called The Renegade Cut. Because if you watch actual Highlander 2, you will just walk out of that movie being like, what the fuck just happened? That makes no sense. All I saw was Sean Connery and that other guy just arguing with each other the whole time. If you watch The Renegade Cut, that's when they let him put in the explanatory scenes that for some reason the producers thought were unnecessary in the 80s. And then the film makes sense and you're like, oh, okay. And it becomes a really enjoyable film. But it made me laugh so much because it's like 10 years ago that I had both copies.
Yeah.
You know, that I could watch one and I was like throwing it against the door like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
And then you get a copy that has these few extra cuts. Dune, the longer version from David Lynch, is kind of like that. So you will understand more about the story. Again, I just think he was in a rock and a hard place. It's not a role that I would take as in, like me. Right. Like if you said, Jason, you can do Dune, I'd be like, no, thank you.
Right. Yeah. It's brave. I think like Denis Villeneuve was brave to take on Blade Runner.
It's the same thing we said about Asimov. Like, I just don't think, you know, we're going to see what they do on Apple TV because obviously coming over to watch that when we get it. But can they do the Foundation? It's been said before that it cannot be done.
Oh, it was a dream of mine to do that.
So.
Never mind.
You still do. This one bombs and fails. Thank you. Then Ed can make his.
That's
own.
How I feel about Terry Pratchett.
Or we can just all make it with, like, you know, origami and stuff. Like, that's what I'm like. Like, let's do it indie budget style. Let's just make some paper mache and. I am the foundation ball. Can you see me? I mean, there's a sharp difference, I guess, between B movies and our crap, but you know. All right, guys. Well, we are coming up to time. It is almost midnight over here, and I need to get home to get some sleep before this big old day tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening, and sorry we're all over the place. We had such a good time on Friday. Like I said, there'll be more to be telling you, because on the back of what happened on Friday, on Saturday night, while Ed was shooting with his crew, I was trying to show some solidarity and wrote a short film, which I am trying to get shot as soon as possible. It is a murder film, and that's all I'm going to say. It's a short film as well, so it won't be very long, but... watch this space, and yeah, we'll let you know how that's going in developments. But please go out and watch this film if you haven't. Pay attention to the camera technique and, you know, start developing some style of your own. And if you have any comments or anything else you'd like to know about the film that we haven't mentioned on here, just put them on the comment section of the podcast. But thank you so much for listening, and bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.